Next up is, it's the proverbial needs no introduction, but it is Vicky Ramsey. Vicky Ramsey is a youth initiative teacher and alumni parent who hails from the East Coast. She loves nature, drawing, and long walks in the woods. Those are all wonderful things. I don't know. Her Meet Me Halfway story is about relationships in her family growing up and is entitled Barrier Island.
The story starts kind of where it ends. There's a lot of circuitous stuff in the middle. I was born in 1969 into a world that is a little like the one I inhabit now. I had a beautiful, loving family, much like what I've tried to cultivate with my own boys. I was the first grandchild on my mother's side, German, Polish, Irish, Catholic family. Who settled on the East Coast, and also the first grandchild on my father's side, an Italian Catholic family, settled on the East Coast. My mom was young when she had me. She was 22, and she was living at home with her parents while she went to nursing school. And she met my dad at a really awesome old Italian restaurant called Zaberer's that was enormous. It was like the size of a city block, and it could serve 1,000 people. And aunts and uncles from both sides of my family worked at this restaurant. And I remember my Aunt Angie used to tell me how she warned my mother. My Aunt Angie was a waitress, and she warned my mother, who was also a waitress. She said, "Maureen, do not date my nephew," who was a bartender. Well, that obviously didn't work, because they started dating, and soon after that, they got married, because I think they were on their way to having me. And they lived together for a while, and then by the time I was 3, they got a divorce. And right around that same time, my grandfather retired from the Air Force, and he and my grandmother went and settled across from a beautiful golf course in Onalaska, Wisconsin, and life got a little harder for my mom. She was a single mom, and now her parents were gone, and luckily, we had a big family, though, and I have a lot of great memories of my aunts and uncles and cousins. But things were definitely going to take a pretty strong detour into a very different world. And my grandmother must have had some intuition about it, because she always told me this. She was like, "Vicky Lynn, you have the ability to cope. You have the ability to persevere. Whatever comes your way, you have an innate wisdom. You can handle it." And I never had the heart to tell her what was going on in my life at that point. And it was enough for me just to spend summers with them and pretend like nothing was going on. When I was young, my mother drove this awesome Corvette. It was sleek and dark green, so dark green it was almost black. And there was just the two of us for a long time. And with a Corvette, that's great, because there's only two seats. And then like this little storage area in the back. And one day we were at the laundromat, and there was a guy standing near us, and he had this wicker laundry basket. And I was like, "Oh, we have these like nested plastic laundry baskets that are kind of ordinary." And I was like, "Hey, Mom, look at that guy's pretty laundry basket." And God, this will come to haunt me for the rest of my life, because she blamed this whole thing on me. She said, so they met, and she fell in love with this guy, and by the time I was 9, she had sold all of her favorite possessions so that we could move to Florida with this guy. And the guy with the wicker laundry basket was someone she wanted me to look up to as a father figure, which was really hard, because he was mean and had a terrible temper that would soon come to define giant chunks of our life and take giant chunks out of my mom's self-esteem. She sold her Corvette, and we traded that for his light blue VW Bug with squeaky brakes. the New Jersey barrier islands that I had grown up with white sand beaches and black rock jetties and horseshoe crabs and sand crabs, were traded for Florida beaches that were strewn with tar and driftwood and Portuguese man-o-war. And Florida was like a bizarre mixture of heaven and hell. It was like just a strange place. And there were, like, I was used to climbing trees and to the saltgrass marshes, and we traded that for me being able to roller skate around a neighborhood and pick mangoes off the trees. My morning tea and toast with my Aunt Angie was traded for my stepfather urging me to smoke pot and take a hit off a joint or a bong, and me learning how to say no to that. Like, the first time I did not say no to that, and it was terrible, and I learned pretty quickly how to say no. And, like, my memories of really good friends and sleepovers were kind of a distant memory as I would lay on the living room floor between the speakers and play records of Jethro Tull and Stevie Wonder and Pink Floyd and Seals and Crofts. I don't know if you remember, some of you might remember that song, like, Diamond Girl, you sure do shine. When I was 9 and a half, my stepfather hit my mother so hard across the side of her head that he broke her eardrum. And she had to get she had to get surgery to sew it back together. But she could only get local anesthetic because she was 9 months pregnant with my brother. And so soon after that, she sent me to go live with my grandparents. And she, meanwhile, was escaping from my stepfather and going back to New Jersey. So she had my little brother in her arms, and she had my twin sisters in her belly. And a couple weeks after they were born, she sent for me to come out and live with them again. And so at that point, I had gone to 3 different third grades, 2 different fourth grades, 2 different fifth grades, and then we were settling back on this barrier island of Ocean City, New Jersey. So the early years with these kids were the most challenging. There were, like, she didn't nurse them. She fed them with bottles and formula. So we had to sterilize these bottles all the time. And there were so many diapers. Like, she'd buy this giant refrigerator box full of diapers to have enough diapers at that time. And the kids were colicky, and they'd spit up and have to change my shirt, like, lots of times a day. But they were super sweet babies, like, just darling. And I loved them very much. I remember some of my friends having some judgment about how much I had to babysit. And I remember one mom saying, like, she's always got a baby on one hip, and she doesn't even have any hips. And, you know, it was just like that, but that was life. In 1983, I was 13, the same age my youngest son is now, and I was walking home from school, and I got in the door, and my mother was standing there in the living room. And she was livid. She was pissed. She was so angry and something else. She was scared. She was like, what did you tell them? I can't believe you did this to me. What did you tell them? And I was like, what? What are you talking about? She's like, Dyfus is coming. What did you tell them? I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then I, like, slowly pieced it together. And I realized that I had been in a class that I was struggling getting my homework done. We had this really big project that was due. And I was I had chosen the project. I was illustrating endangered animals for a calendar, and I could only get it like 3/4 of the way done. And my teacher, Mr. Holden, was like, "What's going on? Like, why can't you finish this thing?" And I was like, "Listen, I have a lot to do, and I don't know what to do. Like, I take care of my siblings after school, and I have to get them dinner, and I have to give them baths and put them to bed, and then I have to do my homework, and then I have to do this, and I just can't get it all done." So Mr. Holden told Mr. Pierfee, the guidance counselor, and then Mr. Pierfee and I had this kind of short, uncomfortable conversation, and then he talked to Dyfus. And so now Dyfus was on their way to our house. Dyfus is the Division of Youth and Family Services. And it was the end of the world, and it was all my fault. And I remember the day that they came, my mother was running late because she wasn't ready yet, and I had to answer the door. And I saw my neighbor, Mrs. G, peering out. She had these big glasses that made her eyes, like, super enormous. And she was peeking out her window. And Dyfus actually was just this soft-spoken woman with a long feathered bob. And she said something to my mom that I had never heard before. She said, "Maureen, you can get a restraining order." And it was like she was offering her a trip to Hawaii, but it was better than a trip to Hawaii because what she was offering her was a chance to keep my predator stepfather away from us for good. And it was too good to be true. And I just waited because I wondered what my mom was going to decide. There had been so many times in the past where she had left him, but then she always took him back. He was always apologetic or soft-spoken, or, you know, he had nice words to say. And, you know, abusive lives aren't just all abuse. It's like just random temper stuff and just really intense experiences that punctuate long periods of relative peace, you know, but you just never know when the intensity is going to happen or when his temper is going to flare or when his craziness is going to, you know, erupt. So she had plenty of times in the past where she could have left him but didn't, or left him and then took him back, like when he was chasing her around that Florida house with a knife and she screamed at me and was like, "Go to the neighbors and call the police, he's going to kill me." Or when he broke her eardrum. Or, you know, so many other times where his temper was just too intense or his words were just terrible, and he's just a crazy, crazy person. So I just didn't know what she was going to do. I kind of waited. And something shifted in her, and I don't know what it was, but it was like she realized he wasn't going to change, and she knew that like no amount of his soft words or apologies were going to cover up what he had done to her and to me and maybe even to my little sisters and my brother, who were 2 and 3 at the time. So she agreed to the restraining order. And a couple days later, my stepfather was standing at the door with the door open, and he was brandishing this stiff and shaking middle finger at my mom, and he was like, "Maureen, payback's a bitch. Payback's a bitch." And then he left, and I never saw him again. My mother saw him 16 years later in an Ohio morgue. That's another story. So life goes on, much like it was before, because he didn't do a whole lot at home. And one day I'm sitting on the couch, and I had just put my sisters and my brother down for a nap. And they had these bunk beds that were like L-shaped, like one on top of the other like this. And they came out and they were like, I think my sister Jamie and Jason came out, and my brother Jason came out, and they were like, "We want a glass of water." And I was like, "Okay, you guys, that's fine, but I got to do my homework. Here's your water. Let me tuck you back into bed." I tucked him in. I was like, "Okay, you guys stay in bed. I got to get my homework done." And my heart wasn't really in my homework, and something must have been in my voice to make them think that I wasn't serious, because a couple minutes later, they come out, and they're like giggling, and they're like, "We got to use the bathroom." And I was like, "Ugh, okay." I let him use the bathroom, of course, and then I got him tucked back into bed. And then, God, poor Jill comes out, because she hadn't gotten her water the first time. "I want a glass of water." I was like, "Ugh, why? No, you can't have a glass of water. Get to bed." And I kind of lost it, and I don't even know why I did. Like, it's not like I was actually doing my homework. But I chased her back into the room, and I went to swat her on the bottom. But as she was leaping into the bunk bed, I swatted her, and my swat sent her further and faster than I imagined, because she was in the air at that point, and she bumped her head on the top of the bunk bed. And she got a little goose egg and a little cut, and oh, she was sad, and I was sad because I didn't hit them, and I was, you know, but I hurt her, and I felt really bad. And she was crying, and I was putting ice on it, and I'm like, "I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to do that, that was such an accident." And I apologized to my other sister and my brother, and then, you know, she had her ice, and I got her tucked back into bed. And then I went and I sat on the couch, and I was like, "God, what kind of sister do I want to be to these guys?" And so, like, this stuff happened all the time. It wasn't like, it was just one of those moments where it was just in your face. Like, how do you want them to remember you, Vicky? Do you want them to think of you like a crazy, stressed out, yelling person like your mom? Or do you want them to remember you with good memories and have, you know, a good memory of you? And I made up my mind then and there that that's how I wanted them to remember me, was like as a kind big sister. So life didn't change a lot, but I think my view about life was a lot different at that point. Sorry, that just kind of... No, it's fine. I'm just trying to think of the next thread. So I wanted to think that, you know, life with my mom and me and the kids was a lot like the Corvette days, where it was like you and me against the world, like we're taking care of the kids together, or we're taking care of this life together. But it wasn't like that. It was much more like divide and conquer. My mom worked all the time, and I took care of the kids. And I had some anger toward her for not being there for us for a while, but I now have come to realize that single motherhood is no joke. Like, if you're a single mom and your kid is sick, you better have somebody who's going to help you take care of them, or else, or what? Like, you don't go to work, or you have a job where you can have them laying on a futon in another room while you teach. So, like, you know, it's a serious thing, and I have a lot more empathy for my mom than I did when I was a teenager. And some of the memories that Jill and Jamie and Jason have, we've shared, like, you know, living on a barrier island is really magical. And, you know, we'd have long afternoons at the beach, and I'd take them to the park a lot, and, you know, they were like, we remember you played alligator under the bridge. And, you know, they'd be, like, climbing around on the park equipment, and I'd be under the bridge trying to get them. And there was, you know, a few times I remember, like, walking home in the rain, and they were kind of miserable, and I would sing, like, the ants go marching one by one. And I forgot to mention the Meet Me Halfway part, but sorry. But, you know, when my mom and I were talking about that restraining order, that was when I had already been doing all these things for her, but that was when I consciously decided to meet her halfway to step up and take care of my siblings. I guess the things that I imagine, I wasn't doing it by myself, though. Like, I was taking care of them by myself, but I had a lot of support. I had my grandparents, who were amazing beacons of unconditional love. And I had a best friend who is still my best friend to this day, who was, like, with me through thick and thin. And, you know, she didn't mind hanging out with me while I had to babysit. And so we just had a lot of adventures together. And I had two awesome teachers. I had a teacher in third grade. She was my teacher in third and fourth grade in Florida. Her name was Miss Reg, and she introduced us to The Hobbit. And I remember telling her about my stepfather, and she showed me the scar that she had in her hand that was, like, covered. It went across the thenar muscles of her thumb and then into her palm, and she said she got it from a fight that she had with her ex-husband. And I just remember thinking that when I had a hard time, I could tell her, and she'd understand, and that scar kind of represented all the craziness that was going on in my house at the time. And the other teacher was my cross-country coach and English teacher, Mr. Naples, and Mr. Naples was an awesome cross-country coach. He led us into, like, by the time I was a senior, we were second in the state. We went to the Meet of Champions. We got scholarships. And he was just, like, he taught us how to persevere through really hard times. Like, you get a stitch in your side, you push through it, you stretch it out. You know, you're running up a hill, you gotta just keep pushing through it, push harder. You don't slow down. You know, he just really helped us find our best selves. And it was a real gift to have him as a coach. But the most awesome thing about Mr. Naples was that by this time I was really taking care of the kids by myself. I was driving, so I was taking them to school, driving back to get to school in the morning. And whenever we had sectionals or like championships or any kind of meet that would take you far away and take you for a long period of time out in the world, you know, you'd get home late at night. I was like, I can't go to those. I have my sisters and my brother. Like, I have to take care of them. And he's like, well, just bring them. I was like, really? He's like, yeah. So literally for 3 years of my life that I was on track and cross country, I'd pack them with their little lunch boxes, and these little peanuts would be riding the school bus with me to these meets, you know. And Mr. Naples was just, you know, he just didn't sweat it, and he'd watch them while I was running, or one of the parents would watch them. And I think about, like, the barrier island where I grew up and how it's, like, a protection from the hurricanes that would pound the coast. And I'd like to think that I was, to some extent, I had the power to do that for my sisters and my brother. And they didn't grow up with a father, but I think they're way better off not growing up with this particular father. And I remember just a few years, well, it was probably over a decade ago, and they were reminiscing about their childhood and their teenagehood, and they were punks that I was proud of, you know, like Liberty Spikes, and, you know, just great kids, very kind and very unique. And then they started going back into their early childhood memories, and they were like, we had a really good childhood. It was awesome, and it was because of you, Vic. Thank you.